WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We are in the middle of a fierce battle for customers among wireless carriers. This week, T-Mobile edged out Sprint for the number three spot. Even Google is offering its own wireless service now with a base sticker price of just $20 a month, which could mean big savings for you. This hour, On Point, wireless carriers duking it out for your business. And later on in the hour, Netflix's one-year maternity policy for men and women. You can join us on air or online. Our question is, have you been paying attention to these ads for cheaper and better wireless service? And what have you done yourself to get your monthly bill down? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now from Salt Lake City, Utah, is Jan Dawson, chief analyst at Jackdaw Research, a research and advisory firm. He is currently working with T-Mobile and Apple. Jan, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. It's good to be with you today.
And thank you. And also with me from San Francisco, California, is Ina Fried, senior researcher at Recode, where she covers wireless issues and devices. Ina, thank you for joining us.
Hi, John.
Ina, so tell me, start us out with where we are in this battle among the major carriers at this point. And I think you're going to get to the point that there are lots of carriers out there that aren't major, but the big four that we all know, AT&T, Verizon, Sprint, and T-Mobile, what's happening?
Well, we've had four carriers, obviously, for a really long time, but what we haven't had is four aggressive carriers. And T-Mobile started really being more aggressive 2 years ago when they brought in John Legere as CEO. And then Sprint last year started being more aggressive. They brought in a new CEO, Marcelo Claure. And once Sprint and T-Mobile were both aggressively going after customers, you have all the ingredients for, as you talk about it, a price war that benefits consumers.
Where are we in the stage of the price war now?
You know, I think it's sort of settled down. I think both Sprint and T-Mobile have gotten to the point that they don't really want to lower prices anymore. So they're shifting things around. They're changing their rhetoric. But what we aren't seeing is sort of prices continue to dip. So I think if you've been waiting on the sidelines, prices have gotten about as low as they're going to get.
Jan Dawson, do you agree with that? Are we at the point where, you know, if you want to take advantage of the situation, now is the time to jump in?
Yeah, it's certainly a great time to do so. One of the interesting things about what's happened with prices is you haven't seen, you know, what you might see in a department store or something where it says, you know, everything 30% off or anything like that. It's rarely that transparent in the wireless industry. Typically, what you see is more for the same price rather than the same for a lower price, or a different structure to an offer from what the competitor's offering. You know, these companies, none of them are super well served by being utterly transparent and allowing consumers to compare their prices directly. And so they all structure their offers slightly differently. They might include different amounts of data for your average plan, whether it's 5 gigabytes or 10 gigabytes or something like that. They might have a different number of lines in their standard plan. It might be 3 lines or 4. And so it's very difficult to compare the pricing directly, but they all have done things over the last couple of years, spurred, as Ina said, by Sprint and T-Mobile, to reduce prices and to make their offers more compelling. And at this point, as Ina says, I think we're past some of the biggest reductions. We'll still see some interesting innovation in the plans and so on. You will still get some savings here and there if you're on a very specific plan, or if there's a certain combination of services that you need that perhaps somebody else doesn't offer. But we've probably seen a lot of the reductions we're going to see for now.
We would love to hear from listeners on this, to get your ideas and actually what your actions are at this point as these ads are running and these opportunities are coming up. Are you taking advantage? And do you have any tricks yourselves for getting your monthly bill down, or some amazing deal you think everybody else should know about? Jan Dawson, can the companies afford to do what they're doing? I mean, are they getting to the point where they're not going to be making money?
It's a great question. The answer is very different depending on which companies you're talking about. Verizon and AT&T are by far the largest of these four carriers. They're much bigger than the others, about 100 million subscribers each. T-Mobile and Sprint are in the sort of 50 to 60 million range. And that makes a big difference in a business like wireless, where a lot of it is about scale, because they've each got to have a national network. They've each got to have a retail chain of stores. They've each got to do certain things with national advertising that have fixed costs associated with them. And so the more subscribers that you have, the more you can spread that cost over those subscribers, mm-hmm. and the more profitable you can become. And so Verizon and AT&T do have quite a bit of profit margin to work with. Sprint and T-Mobile have been much thinner on the margin side. Sprint's been unprofitable many quarters recently. recently. T-Mobile is starting to get into the black pretty regularly at this point, but they're still not comfortably off as far as the margins are concerned, and still way behind the two biggest carriers.
Ina Fried, where we're really seeing, as Jan was just saying, is among the two junior of the major characters, Sprint and T-Mobile, really battling. They're fighting over third place at this point. And there was actually it's gotten somewhat personal between the CEOs. Tell us about that.
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, you have essentially two companies trying to run the same playbook, which is really tough. You know, if only one of them were trying to be the aggressive, you know, alternative, they'd probably be able to run away with things, as John Ledger did during sort of the first year he was doing that. Now they're both sort of running that playbook. And I think there's some mutual admiration between the two and some mutual dislike. And both of those things surface on Twitter. Sometimes they're praising one another, and sometimes they're taking cheap shots at one another, as they both did yesterday.
I found that interesting that yesterday they were sort of insulting each other on on Twitter. Is it a game, or do you think they mean it viscerally and personally?
I think it depends on the day. You know, I think most of the time they have grudging respect at least for each other. And every now and then, you know, Marcelo throws up his hands and gets upset and says something, or vice versa. You know, but again, I think that for consumers, what's interesting is they're both trying to run the same playbook, and that benefits the other big thing that's changed that we should point out is one of the big changes is you used to get your cell phone highly discounted and pay more per month for service. Now you're paying full price for that phone, and the service piece is lower. And that's been a real big change. You used to have 2-year contracts. You'd get that iPhone for $99 or $199. Now you're actually going to pay the full $650. Chances are you're going to pay it in installments. Mm-hmm. And it nets out to about the same thing. But that's been a big shift in how we pay for our monthly cell phone service.
We'll talk about that shift a little bit. I think probably to a lot of listeners, what you're seeing is news, the idea that you're going to pay full price for your phone. And it's going to be $600 to $700 to $800, up to $800 for an iPhone. So what is that move toward people paying full price for their phones about? Where's that started? How many people are doing it? And what are the costs and benefits to consumers?
So T-Mobile started this about 2 years ago, saying, you know, we want to offer, you know, truly the lowest cost cell phone service. And in order to do that, we have to not be subsidizing to the tune of several hundred dollars the cost of the cell phone. Now, very few people are in the position where they're going to go into the store and pay $600, $700 for a phone. So what almost everyone does is finance it. And so what it ends up being is a separate monthly charge, $20, $25. Your cell phone bill magically goes down by $20, $25. So you're paying about the same thing. Most of the others have followed. So it's not mandatory with the other carriers. You can still buy it on a 2-year contract, but fewer and fewer people are doing that. I think in AT&T's latest numbers, I think it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 2/3, but certainly most customers are actually financing their devices over months and paying full price. And AT&T now makes it much tougher to buy it under contract. You have to go into an AT&T store, or you can't go to Best Buy or whomever.
And Ina Fried, if you don't mind sharing, what choices do you make in terms of your phone service?
Well, I make choices that I wouldn't recommend for the average consumer. Uh-huh. Just to stay on top of things, I have one device with each carrier, which is probably the least economic way to do it. I mean, certainly they're going to give you the best deal if you bundle multiple lines of service, as Jan alluded to earlier. And that certainly is more affordable. I think the catch there is as soon as you put a couple different phones on a plan and your wife and your kids, man, it's going to be hard to switch sometime down the road, and they know that. One of the reasons they offer families their best deals is they know families switch far less often.
Jan Dawson, talk to us a little bit about what it is. T-Mobile has recently moved from fourth to third. So in that battle for third, they're now ahead, and it's pretty recent. How did they do it? Can you dissect it for us?
Yeah, there's a couple of things that work there. One is that T-Mobile has done very well over the last couple of years. The other is that Sprint has done quite badly over the same period, and that's really allowed the two companies to switch places much more quickly than they would have done otherwise. On T-Mobile's side, it's really John Legere, who Ina's talked about already, the CEO there for the last couple of years. He put in place this strategy, which they refer to as being the uncarrier. So all the others are carriers, they're the uncarrier. They do things differently. That's the marketing positioning. A lot of it's sort of price discounting that's dressed up in this interesting marketing language of being disruptive and being the kind of consumer's friend and so on. But ultimately, they've set their stall all around being different and eliminating a lot of the pain points and so on that carriers traditionally present you with as a customer. So make it easier for you to upgrade your device, not locking you into a contract, although there's some sort of fine print around all that, having cheaper pricing, allowing you to roam overseas for free rather than paying through the nose when you do so. Lots of these things that kind of eliminate some of the things that people hate most about their carriers. And in the process, they've been very successful winning new subscribers. And at the same time, they've done a much better job of holding on to the subscribers that they have. And they've done that largely by dramatically improving their network coverage, rolling out LTE or 4G service across most of their network here in the US. And that's really allowed them to give their existing customers a much better experience. And so in wireless, it's really about how well you hold on to your customers and how well you do at winning new customers. And T-Mobile's done both of those things very well, whereas Sprint over the last couple of years has really struggled to hold on to its customers, whereas T-Mobile's network's been improving. Sprint's network's had a lot of disruption because they've been upgrading it. And that caused problems for a lot of customers who actually saw a worse experience in the short term, even though long term it should get better. And so they lost subscribers, and they also had a really muddled position in the market where they weren't very clear about what they stood for. And so nobody really kind of associated any particular good things with Sprint either. And that made it hard for them to capture new customers. So you've had these two carriers going in opposite directions, essentially, and that's allowed T-Mobile to very quickly pass Sprint and now take that third place in the market.
This is On Point. I'm John Donvan, and for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about the future of wireless and how far this fight for customers will go. We're talking with Jan Dawson. He is chief analyst at Jackdaw Research, and that is a research and advisory firm, and with Ina Fried, senior editor at Recode, where she covers wireless issues and devices. And it strikes me that a lot of what we're talking about, and even I think the competitors are playing off against, is huge customer dissatisfaction with cell phone pricing. And we put out questions to our listeners to drop by our Facebook page, where our question was, would you consider dropping your wireless plan if it meant cheaper service? And here's some answers. Gabriel Zawadzki says, I just did it this year and could not be happier. Ezra Kazee, the problem is that most of these cheaper options currently don't serve the middle of nowhere America, so to speak, so it's not an option. And Bruce Arkwright Jr. says, I got a Galaxy and Skype. That's all, folks. And even the companies themselves, if you listen to their commercials, what they seem to be playing off of is this deep dissatisfaction. T-Mobile runs a spot where they show what it would be like if the game of baseball had something comparable to the rules in wireless and players got penalized for going over their monthly allowance of hits.
Well, Hopper's coming up to the plate. You know, I don't believe it, but he signed that 2-year contract that puts him on a limited hit plan.
Absolutely terrible. He gets fined for getting too many hits.
And he's already over his monthly hit limit. And there's a base hit up the middle.
And here come the overages.
All right, so that's T-Mobile. Then Sprint is a commercial, also sports-related, where they have British soccer player David Beckham trying to find an unlimited wireless plan for himself and all of his friends.
All I want is something that's unlimited. I want to talk all I want, text all I want, watch movies, and pick the phone that I want, all in for one price.
Sure. Anything for you, David Beckham.
Oh, and I want it for all my friends.
Okay.
Okay, then.
And now into this process comes Google. And Google, known for great products and not necessarily the greatest customer service. Ina Fried, talk to us about Google's Project Fi, what that is and how revolutionary you think it is.
So what Google's trying to do is kind of tweak all the major carriers a little, I think. I think they're not really interested in being in the long-term provider of cell phone service, but they do have a pretty interesting offer right now where they're combining networks for the first time. So their service, they don't have their own cellular network. They're actually using Sprint and T-Mobile in the background. And they're actually dynamically switching between the two. But what's revolutionary or at least different about them is you pay exactly for what you use. So it's $10 a gigabyte. If you use less, you get refunded. If you use more, They charge you that $10 a gigabyte. It's one price. So it's not unlimited, which Sprint still offers, but it is very clear pricing. And they are also in a direction I think we're going to go. They're trying to move as much traffic as possible onto Wi-Fi networks.
Jan Dawson, I'm a little confused by Ina Fried saying that Google isn't entirely serious about wanting to get into the business. So what business is it that they want to get into by offering this really pretty remarkable technologically and from a customer point of view, very attractive sounding service?
Yeah, I think for Google, what this is about is overcoming a fundamental challenge that Google faces in the wireless market, which is that it has very little direct control over how its services end up in people's hands. Because Google makes Android, which is the most popular operating system for mobile phones in the world today and in the US as well. But it basically hands that over to a variety of companies that actually make the phones, from Samsung to LG to Sony. And those companies then customize it. They add all their own services and design to it and so on. They then go to talk to the carriers, and the carriers say, would you tweak this? Would you add this? Would you put our service here on this? And by the time it ends up consumers' hands, it actually looks very different from the product that Google created. And then, you know, Google must be looking over enviously at Apple, which, of course, creates the whole thing end-to-end in a very controlled way, from the phone itself to the software that it runs to the applications that go on it. They steadfastly refuse to have any carrier services or anything preloaded onto the devices. And so you have this contrast. And I think Google wants to create a sort of all Google experience for the really diehard Google users. And I think that's to some extent what Google Fi is about. The other thing is that it's really a way of pressuring the carriers into innovating. And Google's done something similar in landline services with its Google Fiber offering that's available in a handful of cities around the country as well.
Let's bring in some listeners now. And Brian is calling in from Nashville. Brian, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
Hey, how are you? What did you want to talk about?
Sure. I just have a comment. I actually work in the wireless industry, and please don't get me wrong. The company that I work for, being a major player in the industry, they're a great company. They're very good to me. However, even with my employee discount, I found options outside of my company for a better rate.
So are you with one of the big four that we're talking about?
I'm with the number one. Yes.
Okay. All right. That would make it Verizon, I believe.
And yes.
Okay.
And I went, you know, I have two lines. I went with Cricket, and they're now on the AT&T network. I have two lines. I pay $70 a month, tax included. I cut my rate in half. And with them being on the AT&T network, even in, you know, for lack of a better term, the middle of nowhere, when I'm visiting family out of state, perfect service, and I could not be happier. Now, granted, the customer service was not the best with Cricket, mm-hmm. With the calls being answered out of the country, but I alleviated that problem by simply having my monthly bill, you know, direct debited out of my account. So, you know, I'm very happy.
All right, Brian, thanks for your call. And that actually is very useful to us to take us in another direction here. And that's talking about, what Jan Dawson, what Cricket represents. And I'd actually like to take it from this point of view. I think a lot of people feel insecure with the notion of not relying for their phone service on a company that's not a major, major player, that there would be a concern about the system going down, being able to reach them, that company going out of business. And yet we just heard Brian say he works for one of the big companies and he's very satisfied with this little guy. So what is a Cricket? What does a Cricket represent? How many of them are there and how do they work technically?
Yeah, this is a whole other tier of the market from the one that we've been mostly talking about so far. And there's really two kinds of companies that are, or brands, I should say, in that category. One is there are a whole variety of companies that don't own networks, that are just independent companies, and all they are is service providers, and they pay one of those big four carriers, or in some cases several of them, to use their network to provide that service. The other category is that there are sub-brands, as they're called, owned by some of these big companies. So Cricket actually is owned by AT&T today. They don't really emphasize that in their advertising because AT&T doesn't want to make people think it's exactly the same as its main service, but it is these days owned by AT&T entirely. It runs on the AT&T network. And Sprint has brands like that. T-Mobile acquired Metro PCS a while back. They're very similar to Cricket in that sense. They're a prepaid carrier. Many of these companies are prepaid, so you pay for your service up front rather than having a contract that you're locked into where you pay at the end of the month. But there are a whole variety of them. They all run off the big carriers' networks. And the key is just to figure out which network are they running off. Are you going to get the coverage that you want from that particular carrier? And in many cases, you can get a much better deal. You may not get all the fancy features. You may not get all the services that they offer. You may not get the best network in some cases. Some of these companies are limited to 3G rather than 4G service. But these days, a lot of these services from these smaller brands and smaller companies are very competitive and comparable to those that you get from the big brands.
Let's bring in Diane from Houston. Diane, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
Hi.
I've been a Sprint customer since 1999, and I finally got an iPhone at the end of 2013. And I'm in Houston, and I can echo Don's remarks about the Sprint network. I've sort of been a victim of their long process of upgrading, mm-hmm. and there are still a few of us that don't use Wi-Fi at home, so I use my iPhone for data, and I can get almost no coverage in my entire neighborhood, and I'm in close in Houston. I'm not out in the burbs or anything. Mm-hmm. And so, even though I've been a customer of them for a long time, they're not going to let me out of my contract, which isn't up until December. So, it's really frustrating to have the best phone in the world or one of the best phones in the world and not be able to take advantage of all it offers. I can go, you know, a couple of miles away and get blazing fast. Internet speeds off the phone, but not within about a 1 mile area of where I live.
So, Dan, I'm curious as you listen to the program and listen to this discussion of our guests and even some of our callers so far talking about actually there are a lot of other ways to go about getting phone service, and you have picked, and I have as well, one of the major companies, and that sort of more orthodox way. Does this conversation make you think, you know, I'm going to try out some of these new things or look at them more deeply, or do you like the security of go ahead.
Well, as soon as my contract is up in early December, I'll be switching because so that I can take advantage of better service. Absolutely. I mean, Sprint does have unlimited data, which is great if you're watching movies mm-hmm. on your phone, which I do. So even Google's deal might not be feasible for me because I'm a pretty big data user, but a lot of times just getting it to come on without interruption is hard. And I've been round and round with them. They've given me some credits every once in a while for bad service, but the upshot is you'd rather just pay the freight and get the service.
Yeah.
And so what Jan was saying about Sprint's, losing customers because they've been upgrading for so long and in that process, their coverage is really crummy.
All right, Dan. So, thanks for your call. I want to go to Brian in Nashville. Brian, I think you're our second Brian from Nashville this morning. I'm assuming you're a different Brian, but welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
Hi.
I dropped my AT&T service just yesterday after close to 10 years.
Wow.
I switched over to a company called Straight Talk, mainly because of the international dialing rates. I'm Canadian, and my monthly international long-distance charges with AT&T ranged anywhere from $60 to $120 a month on top of my bill. And Straight Talk offers a $60 a month flat fee, all international calling and domestic calling. And when I told them that, they offered to give me 1 cent a minute international calling. But I declined. They gave me a good deal when I told them I was leaving, but I'm leaving them for good.
You're out the door. Okay, Brian, thanks for your call. Another new entry to this conversation, we've talked about Google getting into it. Then there's Facebook, and a video on Facebook's internet.org page. Facebook outlines its new plan to provide internet worldwide through the use of solar-powered drones.
Imagine it. For the first time in history, humanity firing on all cylinders. Everyone. Everywhere. New voices, new dreams, new inspirations. And here's the thing. We can do it. It starts up here at 60,000 feet with planes powered by the sun, opening up the internet to people everywhere.
Wow, Ina Fried, what is that guy talking about?
So this is, again, not really going to help any of us in the U.S. who are well-served, but there are lots of parts of the world that don't have high-speed wireless, and companies whose main business is the internet say, wait, that's an opportunity we're missing. So Google has Project Loon, which is hot air balloons, and Facebook has solar-powered drones, and the idea is to bring internet to places where it's either non-existent or still slow, older 2G wireless networks. And they, you know, they have a big interest, and this is going to bring a lot more people onto the internet eventually.
Jan Dawson, and do you agree with Ina Fried that, that's interesting but not terribly relevant domestically? Or the reason I'm asking, I'm thinking there might be people in geographically underserved areas in the U.S. who might benefit from having one of these drones up there.
Yeah, that's the one area where it might just be relevant in the U.S., but of course those companies won't be the only ones trying to meet those needs. And, you know, AT&T has just finished acquiring DirecTV, which provides satellite television service, and they made some pledges during the course of trying to get that deal approved that they will cover certain rural areas. And one of the ways they'll do that is either with satellite coverage or other coverage that's different from the way the wireless carriers normally reach these areas, especially those that are particularly remote. And the U.S. does have some of these very wide open spaces where the population is very sparse and the traditional technologies really aren't a good fit. And so there will be pockets of the U.S., especially in the West and Midwest, that will be relevant for these kinds of things. But what Facebook and Google are doing here is saying, we're going to come to a point where we've maxed out the users that we can find that are already connected to the network. We have to get more people online so that we can continue to grow our businesses. And so although there's an altruistic component here and that it's good for these people to get online, there's a profit motive too, which is all about getting people in these markets where they don't have good internet service today or wireless service onto the internet so that they can become future Facebook and Google customers.
Let's bring in Kevin from Springfield, Illinois. Kevin, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
Hey.
I just have a real quick couple questions. One, what does your panel think about the service Ting, T-I-N-G?
P-I-N-G, okay. P or T? Yeah.
T as in Tom.
Okay. I'm not familiar with it. Are either of you, Jan or Ina?
Yeah, it's one of this category that we haven't talked a lot about, but that Jan mentioned of these are smaller companies who are offering service, buying it in bulk from one of the carriers. In Ting's case, they're using Sprint's network. Most of them are using either Sprint or T-Mobile's network. And, you know, they do have very competitive prices. A lot of them have fewer device options, so you're either going to have to bring your own phone that works on the network and you have to figure out which network they're on, or you have to choose from a small lineup of devices. But they do offer service often at a fraction of the price that you'd pay the major carriers.
I think Kevin had also wanted to get to a second question where he was concerned about data. Is there a best situation for people whose families use a lot of data? Is there an obvious answer there? Jan Dawson,
well,
you
I
take
think
that?
Yeah,
go,
yeah.
Go
there's
it,
really no obvious answer. I mean, Verizon and AT&T are very much on the sort of tiered data plan model. In other words, you pick a tier of data, how much you want to consume each month, and then you have to try very hard to stay within that tier, or you end up hitting the overages that were the subject of that T-Mobile commercial that you played earlier. With Sprint and T-Mobile, they both offer unlimited in various forms, and one of your earlier callers was referring to that on Sprint. The great thing about that is that you are, at least in some cases, on a completely unlimited plan where you can use almost as much as you want during the course of the month. The bad news is that it tends to come from the two smaller carriers whose coverage isn't as good. So that's the downside, and so it's a trade-off that you're making.
All right, I want to thank our guests and our experts, Jan Dawson, Chief Analyst at Jackdaw Research, a research and advisory firm. Thanks so much for joining us, Jan.
Thank you for having me.
And Ina Fried, Senior Editor at Recode, where she covers wireless issues and devices. Thank you, Ina. After the break, we take a look at Netflix's new maternity and paternity policy. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. And this Tuesday, Netflix expanded its maternity and paternity leave policy for its employees. They're saying that a new mother or father can take up to a year off at full pay. Now, the tech industry has been known in the past for generous benefits, but nothing this generous. We're going to take a look at the upsides and the potential downsides of this policy. Joining me now from Washington is Sarah Jane Glynn. She is Director of Women's Economic Policy at the Center for American Progress. Thanks very much for joining us, Sarah.
Thanks so much for having me on.
And also joining us from Tampa, Florida, is Abigail Hall. She is Professor of Economics at the University of Tampa and Research Fellow at the Independent Institute, a think tank which is based in Oakland, California. Welcome, Abby Hall.
Thanks. Hi, John.
So let's start, Sarah Jane. Can talk me through what the details of what Netflix is offering. I gave a very broad outline of it.
Sure. So Netflix's new policy basically says if you have a new baby or if you adopt a new baby, you've got flexibility in that first year. So you can decide what type of leave makes sense for you and your family. Potentially, you could take the whole year off. You could go on leave for a little while, return to work either full or part-time for a bit, then go back out on leave. They're really trying to maximize flexibility to make sure that their workers can do what fits for them. And it's really revolutionary, not only in that it's offering more leave than any other American company I'm aware of, but it also offers the same amount of leave to all types of parents. So whether you're a birth mother, a biological father, or an adoptive parent, you've got access to the same type of policy, which is a really unusual shift.
And what do you think is Netflix's purpose in doing this?
Well, I think they recognize that there's a very strong business case for offering these types of policies. You know, part of it is about recruitment. Netflix is a company that wants the best and the brightest, and offering a very competitive benefit package is one way to get people to want to come work for your company. But it's also an incredibly important tool in retaining workers. You know, Google expanded their maternity leave policy not terribly long ago, and one of the main reasons they did it was because they recognized that women were leaving their company and they were losing an incredible resource. And when they increased their maternity leave, they saw their retention rates increase by 50%. So it's not just about bringing people into the company. It's also about helping them stay.
Well, as you mentioned, Sarah Jane, Google has recognized this. How does the terms of the Netflix benefit compare to other tech companies in general?
So it's much more generous in terms of length of time. Like I said, I'm not aware of any other American company that offers the potential for up to a full year of leave at 100% of pay. But it's also unique because it offers that flexibility. So, you know, you could take it all in one chunk. You could take intermittent leave. You have the opportunity to return to work part-time but maintaining your full-time salary. So it's much, much more flexible than any other policy that I'm aware of.
And Abby Hall, let's hear from you. What do you make of the announcement overall?
I really agree with what Sarah said, is that it seems that Netflix is really using this policy as a way to attract and retain some really top talent. So if you look at the statement that the chief talent officer from Netflix released along with the announcement, that's what he basically says, is that they recognize that the success of their particular business hinges on keeping the talent that's in their field. And so they see this policy as a way to potentially enhance their business.
You know, in my question to listeners, I said, would you take advantage of it and take the full year off? But is taking advantage of it isn't necessarily even taking the full year off. It sounds as though the flexibility, Abby, is part of the benefit, that it doesn't have to be the full year. It can be, but it can be come and go.
That's right. And one of the things that Netflix is known for in looking at the company is that this policy is really an expansion of the culture that already exists in the company. So for a long time, Netflix actually doesn't track work hours. It doesn't track days per week that its employees work. It also has a very liberal, if you will, vacation policy, so employees can take unlimited vacation. So it's really just an expansion of what is already kind of in place, just putting it in a slightly different context of family.
So does that experience suggest then that that this move is very, very carefully thought out as being to Netflix's benefit, and that if the price for Netflix is that they may have employees who are only partially engaged part of the time, that's okay?
I think absolutely it's a calculated decision. one of the things about paid maternity leave that people discuss fairly frequently is this idea, well, if one company can do it, why not every company? Netflix is going to be keenly aware that its employees are going to be taking time, and there's the possibility that there may be some abuse of the system. Mm-hmm. But again, I think it goes back to this important idea of the culture, which is already existing in the company, in which case if you are using benefits packages, if you're using salaries to attract and retain really good employees, then the employees that you're going to attract are probably not going to want to abuse the privilege because they know that there are going to be other people who are going to be competing for those jobs.
Oh, interesting. Sarah Jane Glynn, are there downsides for the employee in this program?
Well, I mean, I think it's too early to say exactly how this is going to play out. I mean, they just made the announcement this week. Obviously, no one has taken advantage of it yet. So, you know, on the one hand, it's hard to anticipate how exactly it's going to work. But I think Abby makes a great point, which is that this is a continuation of a system of leave that they already have in place. You know, offering unlimited benefits is complicated to administer in part because there are all of these questions about how much leave will people take, what are the guidelines, what are going to be the norms within the business. And because they're expanding on something that they already have, I think it's much easier for Netflix to implement this type of policy than it might be for an organization that didn't already have that type of structure and that type of environment among their workforce. But I think, you know, offering the flexibility to me is the most compelling piece of this. I mean, obviously, the very extended time frame is wonderful for folks as well, because those early days are so important when you have a new baby. But I think that the flexibility piece is what I would want to highlight as being so important, mm-hmm. because it enables people not only to figure out what works for them, but also to coordinate benefits with their partners. You know, most folks don't have this generous of a benefit package. And so if you're partnered with someone who doesn't necessarily have this kind of leave program, you know, this will allow you to make sure that somebody's there with the baby and be able to coordinate the competing benefit policies from different organizations. So I think that that's really important.
Let's bring in some listeners, and I'd first like to invite in Graham from Harrisonburg, Virginia. Graham, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
Hi.
The point I would like to make is I'm from Scotland, and I'm married to an American lady, and we live in America, and we have two children, two beautiful boys, and when they were born, my wife basically had 6 weeks of paid leave from her job, and then she had to go back to work. My sister in Scotland, Jennifer, she also has a job, and she has two children. And with each child, she had a statutory right, which all women have, where she had 6 months off on full pay, and then another 6 months on half pay. And the employer, by law, is mandated that they must do that. And I feel like it has a very negative impact on the child, and on the family, and actually on American society, that the whole mindset is that this is something wonderful and, you know, kind of outlandish that Netflix has done this.
Oh, interesting.
I think this is really a very basic right that people should have, and I think America's way behind the ball with the other industrialized countries.
So in a sense, Graham, you're saying you find it a little silly that we're celebrating. I'm unfamiliar with the policy in Scotland where you say there's a statutory right to 6 months on full pay and 6 months on half pay. So my question is to you, if you know, is that all companies regardless of size, or is there, you know, I'm assuming that would not apply to, you know, a mom and pop restaurant or to some sort of small business, or am I wrong about that?
I believe that you're wrong. I believe it's a statutory right that all
everywhere
women have in the United Kingdom. And again, it goes back to this idea in America where the interests of business are primary over the interests of the workers. And I really feel like, you know, people have a right to spend time with the baby and to foster a family environment, and I feel in America that's taken away, and it's always the excuse is always, well, we can't afford that.
All right, well, Graham, I'm asking you. I'm just cutting in to bring some of your points to our two guests, Sarah Jane Glynn. We haven't at all talked about this becoming mandatory or statutory. What do you think of that? I mean, the U.S. does have laws on this, but for far smaller numbers, and it does depend on the size of the company. I can't see at this point politically something like this becoming the law of the land or anywhere close to it.
Well, I'm so glad that we got this call because it's a really important point. It's absolutely true that the United States is the only advanced economy that doesn't guarantee workers the right to any form of paid leave, let alone paid parental leave. But one thing that's really important to keep in mind when we're talking about other programs in other countries is that the expectation in Scotland is not that the individual business is going to pay that leave. It's a government program that provides wage replacement.
Oh, okay.
And so, you know, that's one of the things that's so important to highlight in talking about this Netflix case is that this is a tremendous boon for employees there. But we know that nationally, only about 12% of American workers have access to paid family leave through their employers because we don't have any sort of mandate and we don't have any sort of large-scale national program to provide wage replacement to new parents. There are three states that have implemented programs. California's had a program in place for over a decade now. New Jersey and Rhode Island created their programs more recently. And those are social insurance programs that are funded through very, very small payroll taxes. And they provide wage replacement to new parents and to people with other types of family caregiving needs when they can't be at work. So I think that while you're absolutely right, it's unlikely that we're going to see a business mandate that would require individual employers to pay for leave. And I think that that would be problematic for a lot of different reasons. Small businesses would have a hard time funding that, et cetera. I do think that there's a tremendous movement going on right now to try to create a national program that would be much more similar to what we see in other countries. And I'm very optimistic that that's something that we're going to see in the not too distant future.
What's your take on that, Abby Hall?
So I would agree that there is a push to definitely expand parental leave in the United States. Although, unlike Sarah Jane, I think that I would be much less excited about seeing such a policy enacted. And there are a few reasons why. And actually, the biggest reasons have to do with the women, largely, who are taking advantage of maternity leave. So Graham mentioned the policy in Scotland. People typically hold up the Nordic countries as being this pinnacle of maternity leave. So they see these countries that have, you know, 36 or a full year of paid maternity leave. But what they don't typically talk about, and this there was an article in Time magazine not too long ago that actually discussed how these maternity policies actually can wind up harming women. We see skill depreciation, so women leave the offices for long periods of time. They come back. They don't have the same kind of skills that they were before. They're a little bit rusty, for lack of a better word. And they actually find out that these policies tend to harden the glass ceiling. So women in the U.S. where we don't have these mandated policies are more likely to achieve their career goals than their European counterparts. And women have more opportunities, and you see more women in upper management positions in the U.S. than you do in these countries with these generous maternity policies. They boost their ratios by mandating quotas of how many women you have to have in the boardroom. And ultimately, when it comes down to a payroll tax or taxing individuals in order to take leave, it seems to me that it's really what that comes down to is you're preferring one group at the expense of another. So you are giving this privilege, this benefit to people who decide to have children, and the people who are bearing that cost would then be people who don't get any of the benefit. So people who plan not to have children or who are past reproductive age.
Let me bring the point that you just, the first part of the point that you were making that this is trickier for the employee, particularly the female employee, than it seems at first glance. That going away for a year, if somebody takes it that way, may actually not be the greatest thing for her career. What about that, Sarah Jane Glenn?
Well, I think the piece that's missing from that conversation is the fact that men are parents, too. And one of the things that is really unique about the conversation here in the United States is that legislation that has been introduced at the state and at the federal level to create paid leave policies is gender neutral. It offers the same amount of benefit to both fathers and mothers. And we're seeing increasingly that men are reporting more and more work-life conflict, and particularly millennial men who are becoming fathers for the first time are reporting how important it is for them to be able to have access to paid leave. They want to be invested fathers. They want to be able to spend that time with their family. We're seeing a tremendous shift in terms of family gender dynamics in very positive ways, I would argue, towards much more equitable relationships between parents and between partners. And so I think that once we get to a place where we can recognize parents aren't just mothers, they're fathers too, that men deserve these benefits just as much as women do, then it's no longer an issue about women do this thing and men do this other thing. It becomes at certain stages in their life, people have these types of family responsibilities, and that's something that we need to address because it's just a fact of life and it benefits everyone for us to have healthy, stable children and healthy, stable families.
Abby Held, the part that confused me though is that If the research suggests that there's a loss of skills for women who take strong advantage of the who I don't want to use the word take advantage because it sounds like exploit, who use the benefit, if they're gone too long, their skills may fray to some extent. Seems to fight the argument we were hearing earlier that it's good for the businesses to retain these individuals. How do we resolve that?
Again, it's one of those things that when we think about this, we have to remember that not all businesses run the same. So Netflix sees this policy as something that will be good for its business. If we look at another company, so Amazon, Walmart, the small shop down the street, those companies are not going to operate in the same way. And so when we talk about maternity, paternity, any kind of family policy, we have to remember that these decisions are going to be best made by the people who know their business and who can make the best decisions they can given the information.
Okay, Abby Hall, we're hitting the clock on that one, so I have to say thank you for joining us. And also Sarah Jane Glynn, thanks for joining us. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, the GOP presidential debates, Planned Parenthood keeps its funding, Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 debris identified. Our weekly news roundtable will go behind the headlines. I'm John Donvan, and for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.